Hello, what have we here?
Hey everyone, welcome back to Resistance Radio. It's episode 52. Hope you all enjoyed last week's show, because this week it's all about the Aftermath series. As always, I am Mikey B, joined by my co-host, Danya.
Hello everyone. So excited to talk about Aftermath, finally.
I know, finally. And Jar Jar Binks, right? And we also have Caitlin with us this week. Hey, Caitlin.
Hello.
Hello. If you want to get involved in the conversation, you can get a hold of us on Twitter at @rradiopodcast. Leave a comment on our Facebook. Send an email through our website, resistanceradio.net. Or leave a comment on this post when it goes up on hypeable.com. Also, today's podcast is brought to you by audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/resistanceradio. With over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, get the latest Star Wars audiobook for free today. We have also launched our Patreon, so please feel free to support the Resistance. Check it out at resistanceradio.net/Patreon. There are some pretty cool perks, including joining us in the recording studio, and you get to hear me make mistakes left and right.
It's so great. It's entertaining. I mean, you also get the pre-show chatter where we all mess up, which is even more fun.
That's true. You know, it's not like, you know, you can't add or anything. But with, you know, time zone changes. But we also have things like movie nights, which with the release of Rogue One, that one should be coming up soon. And some After Dark episodes that we are planning. So definitely check that out. Also, if you want to check out some of our merch, that's also on resistanceradio.net. We have t-shirts and buttons available on our website, too. So
okay, so I'm going to interject very, very quickly, because you mentioned Jar Jar at the top of the episode and then managed to breeze. You managed to breeze straight past that, but I will say you hyped it up so much that by the time I got to that bit, I was like, oh, that's it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right?
I kept waiting for more.
Because it's Jar Jar Binks. It's... send in the clowns. Like, I was just like, I was thinking like the really
sad.
Yeah,
sorry.
Like, send in. Sorry, the Mikey.
Yeah, you the hyped funny... it up way too much for
I
what it was.
I did not hype it up too much.
Me yes, so you did.
Beast. You get. What's up? He's so thinking. Where's Eric when I need somebody to talk about Jar Jar Binks with me?
That's. You kept talking.
I mean, I feel so like excited. I probably would have enjoyed it more if I didn't know that it was coming up.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's an I told you it was an interlude, just like, because he put all these interludes throughout all the novels. But we'll talk about Aftermath and all the wonderful interludes throughout the entire series coming up in a bit. Let's talk about the news. So let's talk about what Bob Iger just did recently, talking about Han Solo and Episode 9. And what happens after that. Bob Iger said a whole bunch of things. And he's also staying CEO of Disney, too. Wow. This is a pretty interesting press conference. So, Bob Iger has revealed that the new some details about the new Han Solo film. As well as that they are discussing what's going on after Episode 9. But the big thing for the Han Solo film, not Rogue One, was that it's going to take place... the film is going to span over 6 years. Han Solo's age from 18 to 24. He'll get to meet Chewbacca in that time. He'll be finding the Millennium Falcon, and of course he'll be winning that Falcon from Lando Calrissian in a game of Sabacc, which is what we know. So that's where Donald Glover comes in. Hopefully there's a little bit more Donald. What do you guys think about that? Like, it's a, you know, the film is going to take place over a couple years versus just, you know, a single time frame like we've had with Rogue One and all the other films.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting choice because there's a lot of, like, moments and story beats within Han's life that could be interesting. It's almost like a lot of mini heists within one big heist movie sort of feel is what I get that they're aiming for, but also it's very, very different for Star Wars to, like, jump around the place as much as they are going to be. I don't completely dislike the idea because I'm not sure that unless it was actually about him winning the Millennium Falcon, I don't think that there's any story that I really feel
not the Kessel
could
run.
I don't know. But this way you get a lot of, like, small snapshots, which could be more interesting.
See, the only reason why I think the Kessel Run would be kind of cool is because then you can really find out this. The 12 parsecs means distance, which means he made the run in a shorter distance. Or is it time? And now no one can argue about it. So, you know, that's one of those things that it would be kind of cool.
Yeah, the only thing I'm, like, worried about is that they're gonna do some silly referential shooting first joke, and I'm just like,
I want him to, be, like, look at the camera and be like, Han Solo always shoots first.
Yeah, let's not go breaking the fourth wall.
But it would be really, but okay, you're right, that's really bad, that's dumb. But, yeah, you know.
No, that's dumb, Mikey.
I will say, though, it's really interesting, because the article talks about, because there's no direct quotes of what he says specifically about it, but kind of he revealed details about it. He says, you'll be finding his ship, the Millennium Falcon. It's weird that they're doing this, because we know, you know, he won it from Lando in a Sabacc game. You know, this is stuff we've had since the original trilogy. So, when they say finding his ship, I just find it you know, some of the wording on this press release is kind of odd, but, you know, it's, at the same time, it's not Star Wars press, it's, you know, CEO press talking about, you know, where the company's going forward, because he also talked about Avatar Land and all the stuff happening at the Disney parks and stuff, so.
Yeah, the bit that was more important for me was his comments on Carrie Fisher.
Yes.
And he basically said, we had to deal with tragedy at the end of 2016. Carrie appears throughout episode 8. We are not changing 8 to deal with her passing. Her performance remains as it is in 8. In Rogue One, we had some digital character. We are not doing that with Carrie. So there it is. That's line under it.
From the CEO himself, who decided to extend his tenure till 2019, which would be, hey, the end of the Star Wars films. You know, he can say that. So that's, you know, I like it.
Yeah. So we know for a fact that they're not going to do a digital recreation with Carrie, which I'm glad about. We've obviously discussed this in more detail before, but yeah, that's not the direction they're taking.
Now I wonder, and this is me playing devil's advocate here, so please don't hate me for this.
Of course, because you always do that.
I have to, just to have a conversation. And so imagine we lose Carrie in the film series. We lose General Organa in the series, because she is on a projected, you know, help me Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, help me Luke Skywalker type, you know, projection, right? And all of a sudden, it goes static and goes out. That's not really CGI her.
But no, I feel like they'll probably...
It explains the way why she's no longer there, and we find out that the First Order and Snoke or something like that attacked where she was, and her ship was destroyed, or, you know, I don't know. But it would be something...
I mean, I feel like there's multiple different ways in which they can do this. Like, they can still have her be around without her not being on screen, with, like, people giving messages based on, like, orders that she's given, and... obviously we'll get to it in a bit, but there are extremely talented voice actors, like we saw in Rebels this week, who can do incredible mimicry in their voice work. So
Kenobi!
I feel
sorry.
Well, I was thinking more Obi-Wan. The know, guy who was playing actual Kenobi, not Sam Witwer.
I know, but oh jeez, Danya. Anyway.
What? No, I'm just saying that they could have someone be the voice of General Organa, Leia Organa, over comms. So there are several different ways in which they could address this that maybe won't involve killing off the character as well, because I feel like that's still going to be too close to home for a lot of people to kill her off.
Yeah. It would be.
Yeah. I mean, I know I would have a really difficult time if it happened, even between the time, the space of time between episode 8 and episode 9, if they were to be like, oh, she, like, died in between the two films, or even if they kill her off in episode 9, I feel as though, for me, emotionally, for as connected as I was to Carrie Fisher, that that might throw me off for the rest of the film. Because Han Solo's death was hard, I will admit, but I'm not as emotionally connected to Han Solo as I ever was to Princess Leia and Carrie Fisher.
Yeah.
So for me, I feel as though it would be a huge distraction from the film. Like, depending on where it would happen or come out that that would be the case, I feel as though I'd have a very difficult time focusing on anything else. And I know that that's probably not just me. I feel as though a lot of fans would react that way. We all had such a hugely emotional response to Carrie Fisher's passing. So it's a very difficult situation that they're in. I'm just glad that they've like said that
there's no
her performance is
possible changes. Like, it's set in stone. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
So that's good. I mean, it's already going to be difficult enough seeing her in episode 8. So, yeah. I feel like it's going to be a similar feeling that I had to Anton Yelchin in Star Trek Beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was always sad just seeing him on screen because you knew
how
it ended. I do want to talk more about the Han Solo film, though. We got some stuff from Woody Harrelson saying he plays a guy named Beckett, who's a criminal and a mentor to Han, which is cool that we've kind of learned his character name. I couldn't find any reference to a Beckett anywhere else, in anything that's been published or at least live of Han, you know, with Han Solo lore. So definitely, I feel like this is a new completely character written for him. You agree?
I would imagine so. We haven't really had massive amounts of references to a mentor sort of relationship for Han Solo, so them bringing in a mentor-esque character for this is arguably going to be a new character and a new role and completely new ground to tread, because we've had zero reference to it prior to this point.
Yeah.
Which begs the question of how they're going to make this play out, because then if Han Solo hasn't ever mentioned this person, why is that? Is the relationship not good? Have they not stayed in contact? Did they cut ties like Han and Lando did? Is he still alive by the time we get to the end of the Han Solo movie? Like,
we all know what happens to mentors.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Oh, don't say that. Luke is a mentor now. Anyway, it's really interesting, though, because Harrelson also said that the Han Solo film is going to be the best film yet. What do you guys think? What do you guys think about that? Just like, before I read the quote, the exact quote he said, what do you guys think? Like, could the Han Solo film be the best Star Wars film yet?
No. But also...
Tell us how you really feel.
I know, right? Yeah, I'll just put that out, that no. And also, he is an actor talking about a film that he is currently working on and currently employed on and currently filming.
No,
and
not yet. So he's not currently filming yet.
He's not even filming yet. But regardless, he's basically in the marketing machine right now for a film that he's involved in. Of course he's going to say it's the best film ever. Everyone involved all along the way in Star Wars has always said that the current movie that they're working on is the best one that there has ever been.
Okay.
They did it for Rogue One. They're going to do it for this one. They're going to do it for all of them.
All right. I'm going to read the quote, and then we're going to talk about it for a second, why it could be the best one ever. So, from Harrelson, they're great. You know, any movie's only as good as the director, or in this case, directors. And so, I have a suspicion. So, it's a suspicion he's got. Because if you look at the whole, all the movies, the backlog of every one of these movies, he's talking about the Star Wars films, there's a lot of great stuff, but one might not be as good with the writing in this or the acting in that and the directing in this. This has great actors, great directors, great script. I feel like we're going to make the best one.
But, so I mean, here, so I take exception to that.
I think everyone that's been cast, like, honestly, once they cast, you know, Donald Glover as Lando, I was 100% in, because I had been saying that for a long time, right? Like, that's, I was all like, Donald Glover should be Lando, and that's what happened. Directors, you know, I like, you know, Lord and Miller's work. You know, it's not, like, groundbreaking to me. None of their work has been, but it should be fun. And if they got a good script, it could be a very good film. So, could be the best one. What do you say to that?
No. Like, I cannot get my head around the idea that a Han Solo movie is going to be the greatest Star Wars story ever told.
If they do it smart, and they just say this is a Han Solo standalone film, but it ties in and brings in like a character like Boba Fett, and leads to like a Boba Fett film. So it's its own series. It's not like a standalone. Like, so Rogue One obviously is a standalone film, and Han Solo, we know it's an anthology film. So it's just like this is the single film, right? But if this is actually like the Scoundrel trilogy, which has a, you know, Han Solo film, and then a Boba Fett film, and then like a Chewbacca film or like a Lando film, like, and it all ties together, like that would be a really cool series, and it would be a Star Wars film still.
But does that make it the best Star Wars film, or does that make it a backdoor pilot for something else that could be the best Star Wars film?
But it's still a Star Wars film, then. You, like, you even said it as a backdoor
I'm not disputing that this isn't a Star Wars film, Mikey. Like, that's not... No! I honestly don't think that a film focusing solely on Han Solo is going to be the best one ever.
Well, and the Mother of Dragons, don't forget that.
Yeah, but I'm not a massive fan of her, so that doesn't mean anything to me. I don't know. I'm just
Abed in the morning. You know, it's got
Donald Glover I love, and I love Thandie Newton, so I'm really excited to see both of those. But
got Woody Harrelson too. Like, it does have a great cat. All right, I'm giving you a hard time, Donnie. You're right.
You are, because I have a different opinion. And I'm I don't think this is going to be the best film. Do I think it's still going to be a good film? Sure, because it has, like you said, great actors, a great script, and great directors. But so do a lot of the other Star Wars films. You know, Rogue One also had that. Do I think that was the best Star Wars film ever? No, probably not either.
So, what is the best Star Wars film ever? What's your, in your opinion, what is the best Star Wars film? I'm throwing you on the spot right now.
Arguably my favorite out of the entire series that I feel is the best one is A New Hope.
Okay, I'll take that. That was one of my favorite. That was my favorite for the longest time.
It's still my favorite.
Empire is my favorite now, but
yeah,
that's okay.
But again, the idea of what is the best is always going to be subjective. Like, no one is going to hands down 100% agree every single time. For some people, some of the prequel films might be the best Star Wars films
Episode
ever.
Episode 1, Jar Jar Binks, heck yeah.
Oh, fuck.
What?
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, alright, you were going to say something, Caitlin, I know.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, and you can have a favorite film and it can change.
And that's exactly it. You're right. My favorite film was A New Hope. Then it switched to Empire. Actually, and was Return of the Jedi. I kind of liked them all at one point. It's my favorite. I get in these kicks.
And like, as growing up, like, our family's general consensus on the best one was actually Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, that's why green is my favorite color, you know?
But in terms of, like, as an adult, I'm not quite sure. Because they all have their... Like, they all have their good parts, and it's like, oh, but that one has this, and that one has that, and, like...
Yeah, exactly. I just don't like this idea that before it even comes out, that we're judging it based on a subjective idea of who Harrelson thinks are the best directors, and the best cast, and the best script writers, because that's not going to be everyone's feeling. Well, certainly not mine. I'm not knocking the people who are involved in the film. I think they are talented. But for me, personally, the ones that I'm most excited for from a casting perspective, a script perspective, and a directing perspective is The Last Jedi. So, is that going to be the best Star Wars film ever? Because it has, what I think, the best scriptwriter, the best cast, and the best director. Like, anyone can throw that out there.
Well, I'm going to say this. We're the best podcast out there, so it's all right. See, I led to an actual point. No, I get it. Like I said, I was playing devil's advocate on that. Because you're right. He is an actor on a film that he is starring in. That's coming out and promotion, you know, like it makes sense. But I will say this does give me the more information we get about the, you know, Red Solo Cup film, the more I am inclined to be excited about it. I know, I think we talked about it months ago, almost a year ago, where we're kind of like, maybe I'll be okay, maybe it won't. And then, you know, the more we get, the more it becomes reality, the more I'm like, I'm okay with it. I'm excited. We do have some interesting news from Alan Tudyk, specifically. He really wants K2SO to be a cameo in that Han Solo film. What would you guys think of that happening?
I don't know, because that would suggest that the Empire needs to be involved in some respect, because we don't know exactly when K2 was reprogrammed.
Well, but does he have to be K2SO specifically, or could he just be that droid? And because he's obviously the voice module of that specific droid.
I guess. I mean, then I would argue, what is the point? That's if true. It's just a generic K2 model?
I would agree. Now, here's the argument, though, is Diego Luna, who played Cassian in Rogue One, has been suspiciously ambiguous when questioned about a possible cameo in the origin stories. So, that's where the argument comes that, you know, with, you know, Tudyk really wanting K2SO to be in Han Solo as a cameo, could we see him and Cassian Andor back towards the end somewhere?
I mean, but then you have to wonder about things like, so, what kind of run-in with the rebellion did they have? How much does Han know about the rebellion before A New Hope? There's a lot that could happen and could be done that it would be very difficult to kind of mesh them all together. Not saying that I hate to see Cassian or K2 or any of the characters from Rogue One show up in other stuff, but then I'm like, well, how much do you start blurring the lines between everything? You know, do you get Han Solo tangled up in the rebellion before he had reason to be invested in their cause? Like, does that help or hinder his character arc from the original trilogy if you see him even more so railing against this idea of getting involved in the rebellion?
Yeah.
And doing more work for, like, or depending on what he's doing and what he's smuggling, who's he smuggling for? Like,
well, and didn't he think that Force was just luck?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the Rebellion kind of, like, always, you know, they didn't idolize the Jedi, but they always respected it, and they all, like, believed in the Force and that kind of going. So, I agree. I just really want to see Jabba make an appearance in the Han Solo film. Even in passing.
I mean, Jabba would make sense. That makes sense. And that would feel more satisfying as well. Because then you would see the beginnings of that relationship between them and how Han started working for him. And how he got tangled up, how he got into trouble, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. That is a satisfying connection between all of the films. No, whereas I feel like if K2 and Cassian are in there, it's just shoehorning characters in for the sake of being like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, look, Rogue One is connected to these films too.
Or what if they put K2 and Cassian as the Imperials, you know, because, you know, K2 was an Imperial droid that made Han drop his spice cargo, that made Jabba put out the bounty on his head. So it was never actually the Imperial entanglements from the beginning. It was all the rebels. That would be fun. I don't know. I'm making it up as I go. Let's move on.
Is there a hashtag for your Han Solo movie sucks? Your theory?
Oh, jeez.
We should probably do that. It should just be Mikey's theory sucks.
Oh, God. Oh, steel
hashtag
Wars.
Devil's advocate. Hashtag.
Hashtag I hate everyone. Anyway, let's move on. In early drafts of Rogue One, since we are celebrating Rogue One's release this week on digital release, and then we have Blu-ray, coming in 2 weeks, a week?
Something like April that? 4th. Yeah, it's really, really close.
April 4th.
So. Like a week or, April 4th, yeah, April 4th, and this week we got the digital release tomorrow. We had some information about early versions of Rogue One. And I will say, I kind of like this idea, but I understand their argument was. So basically, in the early drafts of Rogue One, Jyn's mother was a slain Jedi. No? No comments on that?
I think that's
awesome.
My thoughts are the same reason as to why they dropped that story.
Well, yeah. Like, their instinct was they wanted a scene where Jyn is orphaned because of what Krennic does. Like, it makes sense. Like, she is a child of war, and Jyn's being the daughter of a Jedi. But their argument was people would spend their entire movie saying, if her mom is a Jedi, is Jyn a Jedi? Is Jyn a Jedi? Is she going to be a Jedi? Does she have the Force? Like, it makes sense to take that away. But that would have been really cool if she was, like, the daughter of a Jedi. Like, the whole belief in the Force and the Kyber Crystal necklace and all that. Like, it makes sense. And I think I think they ended on the best story they could. But I don't know. I would have loved to have another Jedi, like, bloodline, if you will, in the Star Wars saga.
Sorry, I missed that, Caitlin.
Oh, I was just saying, it would be another bloodline, but apparently she dies at the end of the movie, so...
Yeah, but it would have been cool to find out more, you know?
Yeah, I know. For me, what was more interesting about Rogue One was having characters who believe in the Force and can use the Force and do commune with the Force who aren't Jedi. Because I feel like there's such a huge focus on the Jedi, and with good reason, because that's been the central story throughout all of the saga films, but I feel as though it's like religion. You can't just have one. So having all of these different belief systems works so much better with understanding the universe as a whole. Because having just centering the Jedi as this one single unifying kind of right way of being involved with the Force is kind of boring to me. Like, I hate this idea that they have to be involved in everything, because they don't. The Force is such an interesting concept, and I loved characters like Chirrut Embes, who was so profoundly spiritual when it came to the Force, but neither of them were Jedi. But they believed in it, and they utilized it, and they did everything with it, and they were guardians. And I find that far more interesting. I find characters like the Bendu from Star Wars Rebels really interesting. And, you know, just the Wills in general. That's really interesting to me. Like, I love this idea that this central conflict between the Jedi and the Sith, and then the Jedi and the First Order, isn't the be-all and end-all of where the Force begins and ends. So, for me, the main interest piece in Rogue One was that there weren't any Jedi. And we were seeing the Force and how people react to it from the perspective of other people. Like, everyone is always like, oh, you know, this idea of, like, not believing in the Jedi and the Force and stuff like that. But then you see all of these people still holding on to the Force. And you think, oh, it didn't die out just because there are no Jedi. So, yeah, I don't know. I like Rogue One for how it is. So, yeah, okay, it could have been an interesting point. I also am not a huge fan of all of the characters having no mums, but having dads. So,
Anakin
I don't know.
Had a mom. Yeah, that's all he had.
I mean, for a while.
Okay. Well, you know, Shmi, you know, survived a couple movies. Anyway, yeah. let's move on. We have some really cool Funkos coming from Star Wars Celebration coming up. I think they're pretty cool. What do you guys think about these here? I will say I am not a fan of the Qui-Gon Jinn hologram one. His eyes look weird to me. But
yeah, I mean, but he matches like the other ones that they've done, like Maul and Yoda and Vader. So that's the style of them. But people are obsessed with the holographic ones. Yeah. I love, so these are just so that people know, if you are going to Star Wars Celebration this year in Orlando, Funko are doing their usual thing where they are doing exclusive Funko Pops that you can get at the convention. Obviously, to get into the Funko booth, you have to enter their lottery. So if you're going, head over to Funko.com and their blog, and you should be able to get a link to the online lottery to potentially win the opportunity to go to the Funko booth. But yeah, so they've got a few different Funkos coming out. Rey with the speeder is so cool. So it's a Funko Pop ride. And it's, yeah, that's really, really cool.
I was kind of disappointed with the Rey with the speeder. Her face just looks weird in that, like the way it's designed on it. But the speeder looks really cool. I will say,
I like it. I think it's cool.
Leia in Hoth gear is probably my favorite, though.
Yeah, Leia in, and Luke. Leia and from Luke. Hoth is my favorite. Luke with the cloak and Thrawn.
I also like Chopper, too, but...
Imperial Disguise Chopper. Yeah, I love that one as well. So there are a couple from this collection that I will probably get. The Chopper almost certainly will be one of them. Probably will get the Leia and the Luke and the Thrawn, and I might get the Rey. But there are a couple of others in there that I'm just like, they're not my thing. I'm really choosy with the ones that I get. I didn't get any of the Celebration ones from London. I just wasn't too into those ones. But these ones are really, really cool. Yeah. It'll be...
Did you see those last pictures on the page? The Galactic Plushies? Jabba, Salacious, Crumb?
Oh yeah, I saw those. I'm not gonna get them, but they're kind of cool.
Look at Jabba! He looks so cute! He's got a little frown on him.
Ugh. The only Star Wars plushie from the Star Wars range that I've got is from the Fabrications range, and it's Wicket. I freaking love that one so much. That's the only Star Wars plushie I've got, because I'm really choosy. Like, I love Star Wars merch, but I also don't have a lot of space, and I'm like, that's great that they've got a Jabba plush, but I'm like, meh, it's not for me, but people are going to be falling all over themselves to get that, especially Diego Luna, though he'll probably be disappointed that it doesn't feel like Jabba.
Didn't you just list 5 of them that you wanted?
Yeah, but there's a lot. Like, this is probably the most Star Wars Funkos that I've wanted in one group before. Usually I'm not that crazy about a lot of them. I don't own, like, a huge amount of Funkos. I own maybe 10 at most.
As soon to be 11?
Oh yeah, when Ovi arrives, yeah. He still hasn't arrived yet, by the way. So for anyone who doesn't know, there is an Alex... Well, there's a load of hockey Funko Pops that you can only get in Canada. And so Caitlin got me an Alexander Ovechkin one and sent it to me from Canada because she loves me and she's the best.
Both are true.
Okay,
Mikey's just like, goddamn hockey all the time.
This hockey stuff.
And we have to put up with your terrible theories, but...
My theories are not terrible. My theories are... All right, we'll just move on.
Yeah. Look back up, because I added something new.
Uh-oh, what did we add?
Number F, or letter F.
Ah, yes. Yeah. So, the end of Rogue One and Star Wars A New Hope spliced together. My first question is, with the release of Rogue One, ways away. How is this up on Vimeo?
Oh, Mikey, come on. You're not that freaking naive.
Okay, you're right. Anyway.
It's the internet. Come on.
The internet's here. Okay. Well, I do not condone, you know, I'm buying like 4 copies of Rogue One, so it's all right. But I will say this here. This video is actually pretty cool. I saw this 2-3 days ago when it was first posted. I don't know. Like, it was really nice seeing the end of Rogue One and the beginning of Star Wars. What the biggest thing that stood out to me was the music. Like, the music for...
Yeah, this is the second modified version.
Is this a modified version?
This is version 2 that came out, like, a day or so ago.
Yeah, 3 days
ago. There was an original version that they had where the music didn't... There was a version that came out 4 days ago where the music didn't quite mesh up together properly, and it was a little odd. And, they re-uploaded it again 3 days ago with a second version.
Yeah, no, and it's not even the, what do you call it? It's not even the music, like, mashing up, but, like, the music that's in Rogue One versus the music that is at the beginning of A New Hope. Like, just the music set. Because, again, you have two different composers.
Yeah, well, this is the thing is, in the comments, they said, like, they modified it. They modified the music mix and added a Leaving Hyperspace sound effect because the original one didn't, like, they didn't go into each other seamlessly.
Yeah, so it's not even the seamlessness. It's just actually, like, watching the Darth Vader scene killing the people, like, hearing the music for that, and then, like, then seeing the battle and the music that John Williams composed for it. Like, both are actually great scores. Like, I love Michael Giacchino's score for Rogue One, and I love John Williams, all his scores for Harry Potter, Star Wars, and everything. But there's such a different pacing, even though it's like the same moment in time almost, like the music-wise, that it was kind of jarring to me. And like I understand his comment about he fixed the music between the transition between the two. And he even added sound effects to say, you know, when he comes out and stuff. But it was definitely one of those things where it just felt almost jarring, Vader just walking through. Well, at the end of Rogue One, he just walks through and is just a complete badass, you know, slicing people up. And you hear all the, you know, rebels going, please help us, somebody save us. And then all of a sudden, you know, he just comes walking in and he let the stormtroopers do the firing first before he does it, you know.
Yeah.
Afterwards.
I just found it really interesting to see someone put the two together so you see how they actually connect. Because obviously I've watched Rogue One, and then immediately afterwards, like after getting home, watched A New Hope. So I've watched them in close succession to each other already, but this is different because now you actually see it go straight into it, and I think that's really cool.
See, what I want to see is I want to see a 4-hour version of A New Hope where you see the title says Star Wars, A New Hope, and then as the title crawl comes up, it cuts to the entirety of Rogue One. And then it finishes the title crawl, and then it goes into, you know, A New Hope.
Yeah, like we've said on previous episode, that this is the modified machete order.
Like, you start and says, like, Star Wars, you hit the fanfare, and then all of a sudden it cuts to the first planet, you know, that you see in Rogue One. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
That'd be fun. I like the video. The videos are worth doing. I do like the split screen of, like, of what's happening at the same time, like, timeline-wise. So. All right. Yeah. Let's move on to the latest episode of Star Wars Rebels. Sons.
Oh my god.
No comment.
Okay, so let me put it this way. You already said this, so I'm going to just put it out there. You were not upset with Ezra in this one, or annoyed with him. I actually really was rooting for Ezra the entire time in this one. Like, with his conflict with the people, you know, the people at Chopper Base, him stealing the ship, like, I'm like, yeah, Ezra, do it! Like, I wanted Ezra to Tatooine. I wanted him to go. Like, did you feel the same way at all?
Yeah, no, I absolutely felt the same way because I understand Hera's viewpoint. I understand that they have a lot of responsibilities and they have a lot that they need to get ready for with Lothal and basically going up against the Empire. Like, they've got so much to plan for, and Ezra has a huge part in those plans, and they're on a very limited time frame in order to be able to execute it, and there's more at stake there than just one person's mission. You know, this will affect the entire rebellion. So, I completely sympathize and understand Hera's viewpoint, because she is playing a huge role within the rebellion and trying to make sure that everything runs smoothly and they're able to basically pull everything off. So I get that. But I also really feel for Ezra in this episode, because if you found out, or if you suddenly were aware of the fact that you're not one of the last Jedi, you in fact are one of a few more, that and that one Jedi that is still potentially alive is Obi-Wan Kenobi. You know, they have unbelievable experience in dealing with the Sith and have unbelievable knowledge in the Jedi Order, and even for like training purposes. And then he discovers or believes that Obi-Wan Kenobi is in danger. Why would he stay behind? For him, Obi-Wan Kenobi is a huge asset, not only to both himself and Kanan, but to the Rebellion and the Rebel Alliance in general.
That's my problem with it, is Kanan was so standoffish when Ezra brought him this information. Like, I was like, why? What, Kanan, you're supposed to be his teacher, his mentor.
Yeah.
And like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, seriously, I was like, so pissed also off at him.
But I sympathize with everyone in this, because Kanan hasn't had that vision. And also, Ezra has had visions before where they haven't been true. They have been planted by Maul in order to manipulate him. And that's what Maul does every single time, is he manipulates Ezra. And we know that. We absolutely know that without a doubt. So Kanan, I don't blame him. I don't blame Kanan, because why would Kanan want to go all the way to Tatooine on something that may not even be a certainty, that he feels is Maul's plan in order to lure Ezra there, which he's not completely wrong about that either, the upper hand and to do everything. Why would he go there just to lose every last bit of hope about seeing another Jedi again? Because he's already been through that loss. He's already been through that pain. He's already been devastated by it before. Yeah. Why would he want to put himself through that emotional turmoil when he's already been struggling with loss this season, with the loss of his sight and with being lost and everything like that? So I understand Kanan's perspective as well. I don't think anyone is fully at fault here. There's a lot more nuance to it than just Ezra is completely right and everyone else is wrong. No, I feel like everyone is right in this instance. Yeah, and also Ezra, I sympathize with him and understand and am fine with the outcome of what he did, and I understand why he did it. Do I also think that it was a little bit selfish? Yeah, absolutely. But then selfishness doesn't always mean that you're wrong. So I don't feel it's as simple as Ezra is completely in the right and everyone else is in the wrong. That Rebels does so well is that it's all operating in areas of grey at all times. And so it should be, because they are still technically at war. So that's just how it is.
Yeah, it's the biggest thing is, like, you saw in previous episodes and seasons of Rebels where Kanan was very apt to try to, you know, save who he thinks are Jedi who still exist, like Jedi Master Luminara Unduli. He's like, oh, we have to go save her. And obviously, it was a ruse by the Inquisitors. I think that was in season one. By now, you know, the fact that there's a chance of Obi-Wan Kenobi being around, like, I would think he would want to jump at it too. But I get it. You know, like, they have entire rebellion and battle to, you know, plan. And Ezra just takes it upon himself to follow his visions, follow his gut, which that actually leads to a very good scene on Tatooine with Obi-Wan and Ezra, where he talks about how he was lured here, and that Obi-Wan cannot join the rebellion and help him, at least not now. So, you know, as a story, it's very good. I will say I love seeing Chopper go with Ezra and kind of show up on Tatooine,
yeah.
I instantly was taken back to R2-D2 and C-3PO arguing on which way to go when you see Ezra and Chris Chopper arguing. I don't know if I would say Ezra was like C-3PO, but I did get kind of get that vibe a little bit, so I really enjoyed it. And then it leads up to Kenobi and Maul. What'd you think about this, Danya? Like the final battle. Like, I'll tell you this, I was a little disappointed, but I understood it. Like, does that make sense at all?
See, I'm from the complete opposite place. I loved it because it was so incredible, because it showed the two places that the characters were in time-wise. In respect to, Obi-Wan has moved on so much further than Maul has. Maul is still holding on to the past, and you see that in their stances, because stance that Maul takes to battle against Obi-Wan is exactly the same one and the same moves that he made when he killed Qui-Gon. Now, Obi-Wan recognizes that and recognizes in Maul that he has not changed, and he changes his stance and his tactics to deal with that. So Maul never stood a chance. Like,
I agree.
Yeah, we could have.
But I kind of wanted to see, like, all right, so here's the thing. It's like, in my mind, I'm like, oh man, we're going to see this awesome battle, and it's animated, so we're going to see how, you know, an older Obi-Wan could be still strong. And it wasn't that. But it was okay, though. Like I said, it's very satisfactory because, like you said, he changed his stance and everything, and it was over in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, but then it's basically like a battle between two old samurai masters. It's more mental preparation and strategy over being flashy. You know, they're not young anymore. They're not prone to showing off and needing to be extravagant when it comes to their battles. You know, they are worn in and they are very experienced, and, you know, the real battle isn't what was going on with their lightsabers. It was all in the mental preparation and the mental side of it. And it really had a Kurosawa vibe to it.
It did.
It did. Almost like it was a little bit of that, a little bit of like Pistols at Dawn sort of western feel of that kind of final showdown. And I thought it was beautiful. I love what they did with it. I was so happy with it. And yeah, just, it made so much sense. And the thing of it is that people who are that good don't need to have long, overdrawn fights. You know, it would have been, yeah, visually it could have been appealing, but it wouldn't have meant as much. It would have just been another lightsaber battle. Whereas what they did now is, they've put so much nuance and small detail into it that you actually do have to think about it as a Star Wars fan. I mean, I have a lot of mad respect for Dave Filoni and everyone who worked on this, because for me, personally, it was entirely satisfying. Like, I was screaming the second I saw it, because I was like, this is so good and so satisfying and such a beautiful way to end this story that has been going on for so long.
Yeah, like, I really enjoyed it quite a bit. Like I said, I was a little let down at first, but what happens after it made up for it. Just because, like I said, I wanted to see an episode one style battle between Obi-Wan and Darth Maul. You know, people had talked about, oh, it'd be so great to have an Obi-Wan film. And I was like, oh, it'd be great to have Maul as the villain again, and just tie in Rebels to that and stuff. And obviously, this wrapped up all of Maul's story with Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then we didn't get that lightsaber battle that, you know, you saw in episode one. But at the same time, you saw how strong Obi-Wan has become. You know, how powerful he was as not only as a Jedi. And what he's doing there. You know, he told Ezra he cannot go to, you know, join the rebellion right now. He's got a task. He's guarding somebody. He's watching somebody. And Maul even calls this out, too. And the final three lines, or final line that Maul says, is he asks, is he the chosen one? And Obi-Wan says, he is. And then Maul responds with, he will avenge us. Referring to Luke. Which is interesting to think that in Rebels, they just referred to Luke as the chosen one, not Anakin Skywalker, who became Darth Vader, not Rey, not any of these other, wild theories about different characters, but Luke is the chosen one. And I guess you can argue from, using an Obi-Wanism, from a certain point of view, he is. He's the one that brings Vader back from the dark side. He's the one that destroys the Sith by having Vader destroying the Emperor and Vader himself dying. He is the chosen one that has all that happen. Or to take a line from Aftermath, the golden boy of the rebellion. He is, that's Luke. So I thought it was really cool to see even a young Luke, even from a distance, and Aunt Beru calling his name.
Oh, man, that scene with the binary sunset and the, oh my god, it was beautiful. Just that just final Luke 10 run back seconds.
Into the homestead. Like, it was nice.
I was crying. Like, legitimately got teared up. I had goosebumps all over my skin. Like, I got chills. And it was so good. And it was so well executed. Because that's all we needed to see. We didn't need any more than that. And it was perfect and beautiful. And such a nice, wonderful nod to everything that's still to come. Yeah. Because we still don't know exactly what point they're at in, the timeline. We don't know how close to A New Hope they are just yet.
Yeah. But you have to remember, if Ezra is born at the same time as Luke, he was 16 years old at the start of season 1, and we're in season 3, he's 18, maybe a year off, 2 years off, if you count each season as a year. So we're in that time range of where Rogue One is, but still a year or two before that, possibly. Yeah.
So, again, it just so well executed, this episode. Like, as the one leading into the finale, just so, so, so good. So satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just say, can we give props to Steven Stanton for being for the voice of Obi-Wan?
Yeah. Yes, please do. It was kind of amazing.
Crap. He was so on freaking point for, his Alec Guinness impression. It took me a while to be like, wait, what? it was spot on. So good. Holy crap. Voice actors are amazing, guys. They are so good at what they do. I mean, Sam Witwer has always been fantastic as Maul, but, Stephen Stanton sounded like Obi-Wan from A New Hope. It was incredible. I almost couldn't believe what I was hearing.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Like I said, before we started the show, I rewatched that scene two or three times, and just hearing Sam Witwer, just hearing Obi-Wan and Maul talk, it really felt like watching the live actors who we grew up with, and I instantly was transported to seeing that. Even though it's an animated series, I felt like it could have been live. It was amazing. I do want to kind of go over the teaser that Disney released on their Twitter feed for the season finale, though.
I am not ready.
seriously. just Thrawn saying he's going to destroy their entire fleet, and we just saw Mon Mothma amass that entire fleet in the episode before, makes me go oh my god, what? I can't wait.
How much percent ready am I for this? 0%.
I don't want to know, but I'm excited, but man, it's this last season of Rebels, plus with the Mandalorians, maybe we'll see Sabine again, it should be good. Anyway, moving on to listener comments, we got a great comment to dig me out of a hole, because I mentioned last week I saw Rogue One way too many times in theaters. This comes from Mark saying, hey, at Radio, our radio podcast, seeing hashtag Rogue One 5-6 times is perfectly fine, Mikey Bushiro. I saw it 5 times as well. So, Force Awakens, even 8 times. So, Mark, I agree with you. I've seen those films way too many times in theaters, and it was good.
So, side note for this is that Mark has a cinema pass that he pays a monthly amount, and he can go and see as many films as he wants to. So,
okay, well, I spent more of a fortune on it, so it's okay. So,
yeah. So, Mark was smarter about it.
Well, you know, here's the thing is, I did go to a lot of matinees for Rogue One, like two or three of them, so it was okay.
Yeah.
It's all right.
They do that. I don't know if it's a thing with you guys. So, for example, in the UK, you can also do it. The Odeon have it now, but Cineworld also had it, where you pay about £16 or £17 a month, and you can go and see as many films as you want.
Yeah,
if you go and
that.
See a 3D film, you have to pay, like, I think it's like £1 more, and you have to have your own 3D glasses, or you can buy 3D glasses there. But yeah, you can do that, and it's like unlimited the amount of films that you can see in the month.
That's not a thing here, at least not where I'm at. It's, hey, $16 a ticket. I mean, at night on a weekend.
That's crazy.
Well, it's like $6 during the day, you know, or like Tuesday special, you know, cheap Tuesday tickets.
So, you know. Like cinema tickets here, like if I just go and see a film on its own, usually it's about £10 or £11 if it's a 2D film, which is usually all I go and see. A 3D film, it's around 15, so like a lot more. Mm-hmm. I don't tend to go and see 3D films much, but yeah, so something like that monthly cinema pass is so much value for money. Because it's basically, if you see two films in a month, you've paid.
Yeah,
it's worth it.
I wonder if they'll ever bring that here. But let's move to our spotlight topic, the Aftermath series and the fate of Jar Jar Binks.
Which, again, you hyped up way too much for what was in the actual
but
book.
But it's Jar Jar Binks! Like,
yeah, exactly. So you're doing it again, Mikey.
Oh my gosh. You get to find out, like, all right. So you know what, let's just get Jar Jar Binks out of the way before we talk about anything else about the Aftermath series, which is three books. Star Wars, which was actually part of the Road to the Force Awakens. So Star Wars Aftermath is one of the first novels released as part of the new canon. Star Wars Aftermath Life Debt. And Star Wars Aftermath Empire's End, which just came out. But in Empire's End, which was the most recent book, which we decided to do as our spotlight topic because of Jar Jar Binks, there is a wonderful interlude that talks about him and what he's doing now. So, I get it. Like, I totally get, like, I maybe hyped up the Jar Jar Binks thing a little too much. But the fact that we found out that, one, Jar Jar Binks is still around. Two, he survived the Empire for 20 years. He survived the beginning of the New Republic. He's still there. Like, at this point, like, I don't even know. I don't know how long do Gungans live? Do they live to be, like, 500 years old? Are they, like, Yoda, 1,000 years old? And, you know, he'll be on, you know, he'll show up. Maybe Jar Jar is Snoke. What do you, like,
oh, my God. No. Your Snoke theory sucks. No, I still think this was a great little moment, and it was really interesting to see that he's basically a street performer at a refugee center entertaining children. Like, that's his whole role right now. And the kids love him, but the adults hate him. And
the Gungans hate him, too. He's ostracized from every bit of society that even knows who he is.
Yeah, because, again, he granted emergency powers to Palpatine, so essentially, in the eyes of people who want to lay blame somewhere, the rise of the Galactic Empire is on his shoulders, which is kind of crazy. But, yeah, he's racked with guilt over it, and so just him being able to live his life in this way, doing something that makes him happy, was great. I just, when you were talking about it, I was expecting, like, this huge, like, mind-blowing kind of massive role that he kind of comes back, and it had, like, a huge part of the book, and it wasn't, and I was like, so temper your kind of expectations, guys, if you weren't certain about, like, what was going on, but yeah.
Temper it. Get your hopes up, guys. It's Jar Jar Binks again. He's back. It's amazing. He's alive. Jar Jar's back. back again. Yeah. Like, I'm so excited.
Again.
Okay.
Mikey is overblowing it by a massive amount. It's a nice moment, but it's nice not.
It's actually a very sad, it's a very sad moment to me. Like it's like,
well, so yeah,
the whole interlude, like I'm if you don't want spoilers, like pause for, you skip over like the next 5 minutes, but I'm going to spoil the Jar Jar Binks thing. So that way people don't have to read the whole book to understand what I'm talking about with Jar Jar Binks. All right. So the Jar Jar Binks whole interlude focuses around an orphan boy who has a messed up face because of war, right? You know, he's not the best looking kid. He's kind of a standoff, and he's never going to get adopted. Like, he just knows this. And he's this, like, standoff kid, right? You know, he doesn't really make friends. And he makes friends with the clown, the known clown there. It's a Gungan on Naboo who doesn't really have anywhere to go. And the clown turns out to be, like, as I'm reading this, like, I was like, oh my gosh. I'm kind of like freaking out saying, I really hope this is Jar Jar. And then once it's revealed that it is Jar Jar Binks, like, I got super excited because, one, you found out Jar Jar is alive. Two, you kind of see where he's at and you kind of see the situation he's in. Like, I get it. Yes, he is the amazing senator who gave Emperor Palpatine emergency powers. He brought about the Empire. He, you know, he did a lot of dumb things. But honestly, the only people that have to blame for giving him the ability to give the Emperor emergency power or call for that is the people who made him a senator in the first place. Like, come on, it's Jar Jar Binks.
Well, that, and he was not the only one. There's a whole
thing. Yeah, no. of course. And that's absolutely true. And there is more to it than that. But it's the same with any of our governments as well. Is that if you look at things that pass through the government, through the Senate, through anything like that, it always goes through multiple people. But you usually see the fallback on one person, or one person is made the scapegoat for everything, either because it was their plan in the first place, or they tabled it, or something like that, or they're the one who eventually announced it. So they're seen as, like, the sort of head of that entire thing. So it's easy to pass the blame onto them and alleviate your own guilt by passing it on to someone else. So I completely understand why it happened the way that it happened, and especially with, like, people who might have opposed the idea as well. It's easy to kind of be like, it's all on him. But again, yeah, it was an interesting little interlude, and it was, yes, heartbreaking, but it was nice to touch base with him again and see where he was and what happened to him. Just wasn't as big a part of the book as I thought it was going to be.
Not after all that hype. Yours.
Oh, wait, well, how's it my fault? I get excited about everything Star Wars. You know this. You've been on 52 episodes with me, Donnie. Like, seriously. Like, I get excited about, like, everything. So I personally think this is all your fault. So I'm going to put it there. Anyway, let's move on to
putting blame where it doesn't belong.
Exactly.
This
now
is
you're being as bad as the people
facts.
Blaming
alternative facts, like, here.
I was going to be like, now you're as bad as the people blaming Jar Jar for the rise of the Empire.
Mm-hmm. Right? Exactly. He shouldn't be the sad clown. Anyway, let's talk about the Aftermath series as a whole. Specifically, I do want to focus on Empire's End, which was the last book, because we have talked about Empire, the two other Aftermath series on here, probably not in as much detail. So for those of you who have not read it, Aftermath series is 3 books, like I mentioned. It does follow the story of Nora Wexley, and I guess Grand Admiral Ray Sloan is really the other main character through the whole thing, but it is Nora Wexley's story from the beginning of the first Aftermath book all the way to the end. And you know the name Wexley because Snap Wexley, Temin, is actually in The Force Awakens. You know, he flies in the same squadron as Poe Dameron, who we all love. I will tell you this. One thing before we get into it, I know me and Danya have had very strong opinions about the first Aftermath book. I still have this thing where it really was one of those things where it was hard for me to read. Like, do you agree with me on that Tanya, that the first book was really
absolutely. I would say the first two were pretty bad. Honestly, this one I found much easier to read.
I know, I agree. 100%. And actually, the second one was, I thought it was easier to read also, but I wasn't looking forward to it. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
The first book was such a chore for me to get through. Like, it really was a chore. It was good. A lot of great information and stuff. And, you know, Life Debt, I was going to read it because I was already invested, but it was a little difficult for me to get into it, and I actually enjoyed it. And by the time we get to Empire's End, like, I actually wanted to read it. Like, it was a slow burn to want to do it. What do you think, Caitlin? Like, you read all three books right away.
Well, I had 2 weeks to read, or I guess listen to all three audiobooks, because if I had to read, I wouldn't be done on time. So, okay. Audible.com. That's how you get things
done. There you go.
And they kind of all blur together, because like I said, like it was like a nonstop, like this is why I haven't watched TV in the past 2 weeks, is because I was busy listening to audiobooks. I definitely could see why it would be difficult to read it versus listening to it, because the audiobooks are really well done, and there's a lot of ambient noises to help like kind of put you in the setting, which was really cool. So, yeah, it was kind of interesting because I haven't read the Star Wars books since I was a kid. So it was interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the first two books were a little bit, but the third one was definitely solid and worth reading. And actually, it's really funny is I pulled up a Goodreads website, and the rating of the books, you know, of Aftermath, you know, Thrall from Chuck Wending, you know, it starts at 3 stars, just over 3 stars at Aftermath. Then it goes up to almost 4 stars. And then it's a good solid 4 stars by the last book as a read. So like I said, Empire's End was definitely really good. And it follows Nora Wexley, who was a pilot at the end of Return of the Jedi. For those who didn't know. And she does, she flew inside the Death Star itself. She, you know, she was the one who led some of the TIE fighters away from the Millennium Falcon. So Lando and Wedge can destroy it. Again, Wedge Antilles was good. He's also in the book. We learned some stuff about him. Right, Danya?
We do.
Wow. The lack of enthusiasm about Wedge Antilles. But you know what makes me really sad, Danya? At the end of that book, when Wedge is going to start the school, and Nora's going to be at the school also, guess where the school is?
Yeah, I know exactly where the school is.
It's on Olympian Prime! Please say they move it! They gotta move it!
Basically, oh my theory is probably true.
No, they can't kill Wedge. They're going to move it. Wedge is going to defect and join the resistance with General Leia because he likes Leia. Man, I'm so sad. Like, honestly, so for you who don't know, Danya loves Wedge Antilles, or the exact opposite of that. But she made a joke that he was hanging out on Hossian Prime when, you know, the First Order destroyed it. And at least at the end of Empire's End, Wedge could theoretically be on Hossian Prime when they destroy it, which means one of my favorite characters that flew in the Death Star trench with Luke, flew in the second Death Star with Lando and destroyed it, could be dead because, you know, Kylo Ren had a temper tantrum.
But at the same
time, I mean, technically it wasn't Kylo Ren that had the temper tantrum. Yeah.
It was right? Armitage Hux. He got angry that someone's making fun of his name.
At least blame the right character, Mikey. God.
But technically, Temin survived.
Yes, Temin. Yeah, but Temin also left to join the resistance. So that's why he's flying there. Snap. All right, let's focus back down onto our characters here, our story. So in Empire's End, the conclusion that we get to is that the Empire is hiding out at Jakku. So it's the Battle of Jakku, which we see in the Star Wars Battlefront games, which I think we talked about how, like, I was completely blown away in the games where I, like, you see the Death Star just crashing down to, you know, on the planet when you're on Tatooine, and I, like, you know, die 10 times looking at it. But this is actually when it's happening. Like, you actually see the story of how it happens, how that Death Star gets taken down, and, you know, how it kind of destroys, you know, takes it, you know, the New Republic essentially destroys the remnants of the Empire in this one. And it all follows because, I guess Nora has this, I guess you would say a vendetta against, Grand Admiral Rae Sloane, and she decided to trace her down, even though the New Republic says don't do it. You agree? Was that kind of an okay synopsis?
Yeah, I would say so.
There's probably more in there, as we talk about the other characters. But let's just move through them. I know, Caitlin, you put Jazz Amari as one of the first ones.
Yes, I did.
Here, and I know I kind of figured it. So let's just talk about Jazz Amari real quick. So Jazz Amari is a Zabrak bounty hunter, right? So Zabrak is like Darth Maul's character, which I thought was pretty cool. And she ends up working with Nora from the very beginning of the Aftermath series. Well, tell me what you think about Jazz Amari. Like, why is she an important character in this series?
Because she's badass.
Wow. Okay. Anything else about Jazz Amari?
She's awesome.
Okay.
I'm very descriptive. Right,
I'm gonna stop there. With that. Okay, that's good. But I do want to, Jazz Amari is a very resilient bounty hunter. You know, she is able to kind of escape herself through different things that happen in Aftermath. I kind of want to make sure I talk about her because she's also the one who brings Sinjir into this whole group that kind of formed as a kind of a squad that is kind of I guess this would almost be the start of the Resistance because they kind of go against what the New Republic wants, but they're kind of working for General Leia or Leia Organa. Would you guys agree that this is kind of the beginning of how the Resistance probably started?
I would say it's the fledgling part of the Resistance. I mean, we see the fledgling part of what I believe would become the Knights of Ren as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of threads here that can be picked up and you can take them further. I mean, you know, the Acolytes of the Beyond, I'm pretty sure, are going to be the Knights of Ren.
I also liked, when talking about the kids, when Hux is, has the kids who are, and they're literally feral. They talk about the tall blonde girl who's the most vicious. I'm like, that has to be Captain Phasma. Like, in my mind, I'm like, they don't say it, but I feel like it has to be. Like, especially.
Yeah, there's a lot of threads here where you're like, there's a lot that I would say are clues as to where it's leading to in The Force Awakens and probably beyond as well. But yeah, there was a lot in Empire's End that was really cool. But yeah, I would say that this is definitely the beginnings of a lot of things. Probably Snoke's origin. You know, the Knights of Ren. There's so much here where it's just you're starting to see the first kernels of it all.
Do we know if they're planning another series between Aftermath and Force Awakens?
There's a couple series that are being released, but nothing that is like a full series like that we know of. Like, we know the other one that's taking place between, the prequels, and there is the new, was it Rebel Rising, which is the Jyn Erso book. So nothing so much. So we'll see what happens. I do want to talk about Sinjir Wrath-Velis a little bit as one of the first openly gay characters in official Star Wars canon. What do you guys think about that?
I mean, it's great. Here's my problem, and it's not that it's not as valid, because I think it's great, and I think the representation and the diversity is fantastic, and I really, really, really do love it, but also I feel as though there's a very small subset of fans who are going to be looking at it. So while I feel like it's great in terms of the actual character and the representation, I still feel as though they shouldn't get like a huge pat on the back for doing it. Cause I love the inclusion and I think it's great, but also it's not the same as if they included a gay character or a queer character in the films. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, yes, it's great, but are they doing it because it's more acceptable to do it in novel form than it is on the screen?
Yeah. I don't know. I thought it was good that the inclusion's there. But you're right. As a character, you know, it didn't really make a difference one way or the other. I will say, I think it may have played into the way they styled his character. He was very sassy in general before they openly admitted he was a gay character. But just being sassy, imperial, kind of snooty, uptight was something that I felt. It just kind of rounded out his character. Like, it made it almost not necessarily more believable, but just it felt like it was right. Like, it was supposed to be that way. Does that make sense? Like, if you had to put, I don't know. To me, it's one of those things where, like, when people say, like, I really don't look at a character's sex or gender or anything, like, do they have a relationship with anyone else? But, like, in this case, when they brought it out that he was gay, openly gay, and how he was acting and what he did and what he did before and after, like, it kind of said, oh, it makes sense. Like, it gave me a very full character. Why Sinjar became one of my favorite characters, especially because he was able to just be really calculated and really meticulous when he was doing what he needed to do. So I don't want to give away too much, but, like, he was a former Imperial loyalty officer. Is that what they called him? He was a loyalty? Yeah, a loyalty officer. And he essentially tortured people, which you think would be like, oh man, you have something, you know, he's bad. But when he started to work with the New Republic, or at least with Leia, like, the way he was able to talk to somebody and, like, just suss out if they are, like, what is important to them, like, knowing that he was, you know, his sexual orientation, made it that much more believable to me. At least just in some of, I don't know, maybe it gave me a very good full look at his character. I don't know. I was happy that they did it, but you're right. Just the fact that they finally added something in official canon is not something to really pad them on the back about, but it was good to have him as a character, whatever his sexual orientation was.
Yeah. I mean, it's not... Yes, it's notable in that he's one of the first, but also, again, yeah, there's just a lot. There's a lot more to be done in terms of representation and diversity, and they're moving in the right direction, which is good. But yeah, he's definitely one of my favorite characters as well.
Yeah, I enjoyed him, especially his sass and his competency.
Yep, exactly, his competency for everything. So I do want to talk about observatories real quick. So in Empire's End, or I guess the one before, before Empire's End, we got that interlude about Sharif Palpatine on Jakku doing something. But in Empire's End, we learn about these observatories all over the place that are guarding Sith artifacts. And we know that Gallius Rax is, protecting the observatory on Jakku, which is why Jakku is so important. What do you think about what these observatories could hold, not just in, you know, the Aftermath series, but also in Force Awakens and beyond?
So much! Holy crap, and we know that Last Jedi is going to be going to loads of different worlds and planets as well, so it is entirely possible that whatever is on these different observatories is important. So, yeah, it's like there's Sith artifacts, weapons, there were prisons, like, there's so much. And, Jakku's was, like, built as part of Palpatine's, like, in the event of my death plan. And, the other thing about the observatories that is so crazy is that they can also destroy the planet that they're on. Which I was like, oh my god, this is huge. So,
when that was revealed, like, I was kind of like, wait, they can't do that? There's a whole movie that starts off there.
Yeah. So Jakku, like, really narrowly avoided being destroyed, but also it was kind of like, wow. The fact that wherever there are other observatories, if they manage to trigger it, they could just destroy the whole planet while they're still on it, which is insane. And also would make for, like, some real tension if they decided to go there in one of the movies.
Well, it makes me wonder why Rey was left on Jakku in the first place.
Yeah, well, there's an observatory. And we also know, like, at the same time, you had the observatory on Jakku was being kind of guarded by an orphan originally. And, you know, so it's definitely one of the things that the observatory concept is really interesting. Plus, I think the sentinel that guards the observatory, the one that looks like the emperor himself, but is not the emperor.
Creepy.
And it's just like it's super creepy. Like, but I think I like the idea of these observatories and where they can be, because it also ties into what we know about Luke. Because at this point, we find out that Luke is already searching for Jedi temples. So Luke is not really in Aftermath at all, other than mentioned, kind of like in, you know, The Force Awakens. It's like, where is Luke at? So at this point, Luke is searching for Jedi temples and finding out that there's not only Jedi temples that he's looking for, but there's also these Sith observatories that the Emperor had set up and protected. And well before he was the Emperor, like, it makes it seem like there's a whole lot more history between the Jedi and Sith that we will hopefully uncover in either future novels or in future movies like The Last Jedi. Do you agree on Luke searching? No?
What?
I don't know.
The idea that that's where Luke has been all the time. I mean, yeah, they've been building up to this whole idea that Luke has been gone because he's searching for Jedi artifacts or the first Jedi temple. Like, we know that. That is something that we're aware of through, other materials and stuff. So, yeah, that he's off already looking for, like, Jedi artifacts and other things already by the time we see it in this film, but before, like, Ben's birth. Like, that's...
So what makes him stop and then start the school?
I would guess that maybe he finds some stuff initially, and probably, like, feels as though with Ben born, maybe he should stay and settle closer to Leia, particularly if they sense that Ben is quite force sensitive. So, I don't know. I would say that maybe it felt like he should be near his family, and then obviously after everything else, he kind of goes back to try and search for why everything fell apart. I don't know, that's like spitballing. We don't really know.
Yeah, we'll see. I agree. It's definitely kind of a spitball type idea there. I feel like the observatories and Luke searching for Jedi temples have to be tied together somehow. Just because it's such a coincidence that, you know, it's discussed in the end of this book. But it could just be a coincidence. I hope it's not, though. But I do want to talk about the birth of Ben Solo. It's really interesting that there's that... To me, they had Lando in the book as just another interlude, taking back Cloud City, talking about, you know, Ben's birth. And then you have, like, It was Sinjir talking about people who talked, you know, who were there at Ben's birth, and was Luke there, the golden boy? And some people say he was and wasn't, or that Leia was able to just meditate and he was born without pain. Like, it was pretty cool, like, just to see, like, the legends that started to happen in this novel around Ben Solo's birth. Because, you know, we had the concept of legends in the EU. Ben Solo as a new character, as being born in this timeline, he already has legends surrounding him, as they discuss it in the book. So I thought that was kind of cool. And, you know, it leads to, you know, we now timeline. This is when Ben's born. Luke is also searching for Jedi temples. When does he get trained? Like, where does it go from there? So overall, I will say Empire's End is probably the best of the three books. Definitely need to read all three books to get, you know, to understand it all, because there's a lot going on there.
Yeah,
and like I said,
I'm really glad that I followed your advice in actually going through all three versus trying to jump into the third one, because I would have been so lost and the characters wouldn't have meant as much.
Yeah, and I will say, like, the very first one, the very first book was definitely something where you got introduction to, like, Mr. Bones, which is one of my favorite characters, this droid. And like, Mr. Bones is a B1 battle droid that's been put together, and like, he has like bones on him and all sorts of things that have been put together. And the best description is in the first book. But you know, you get his character. You know, I think Temin says he was a combination of things like a ballet dancer and a murder droid, if you will. Like, he would sing and dance, and, like, my favorite line is, I made violence! Like, it's so good, and, like, the audiobook does such a good job with it. I know you listen to the audiobook, Caitlin, so
yeah.
we can appreciate Mr. Bones and his voice, and I may have to rip some of that audio when to put it in here.
They tried to tweak him so that he would pick up more, like, social cues, and, like, I forget who exactly, I think it's probably Temin, is probably hugging his mother, and then, like, Mr. Bone comes in and hugs him. He's like, are you enjoying the hug? I'm enjoying the hug. It's just like, oh, you would be the worst thing to hug, because all you are is, like,
metal and weapons.
Well, so metal bones, essentially.
Yeah, so, Mr. Bones, one of my favorite characters. Danya, what do you feel about Mr. Bones, since me and Caitlin profess our love for him?
I mean, I also love Mr. Bones. I thought that he was a great character. I haven't listened to any of the audiobooks, so everything I've experienced when it comes to Mr. Bones is in reading. I don't know why. Like, I like audiobooks sometimes, but I'm a lot quicker at just reading. No, so I tend to just read.
I prefer reading as well, but to get all that reading done, like, at least with audiobooks, I could listen and do other things. Like, when I went away this weekend, while I was driving, I could listen to it. Plus, like, it kind of, like I said, it kind of gave more of an atmosphere to it, because if you had a hard time getting into it and reading the book itself. But I'm very much a visual person, so, like, often I knew the names of the characters, but I didn't know how to spell them. And for the long time, there was a character named Jom, and for the longest time, I thought his name was John.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you this. If you have access to our Discord, I just posted an amazing picture of Mr. Bones in our Discord chat.
I have performed violence!
It's worth checking out. It's kind of awesome. So, Mr. Bones, one of my favorite characters. I will add some audio to this because it's Mr. Bones.
Roger, roger!
Thank you all for listening to another episode of Resistance Radio. Feel free to reach us on Twitter at Our Radio Podcast, or on Facebook at facebook.com/resistanceradiopodcast. Also, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/resistanceradiopodcast or resistanceradio.net/patreon. Either one will get you there. As always, I am Mikey B.
I'm Danya.
And I'm Caitlin.
I performed violence!
I have performed violence!
And may the force be with you.
And also
with you.
Danya, you need to listen to the audiobook here. You're missing out.
Mr. I will
Bones.
Do.
Mr. Bones.
He made me giggle every time, and, like, I'm like, that, like, what does that say about me?
Performing violence?
Well, just like,
maybe?
Like, every time he spoke or did something and talking about performing violence, and here I am giggling.
Well, bye-bye now. Bye-bye. Bye.